This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Somebody actually came up to me, a Russian agent, very briefly just whispered into my ears, "You got to come home or else you're dead."
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. This is part two of our chat with Jack Barsky, who spent 10 years as an undercover KGB agent in the United States. He's the longest surviving known member of the KGB illegals program that operated during the Cold War. In this episode, we talk about his first days in the US, his mission, and how he managed to build his cover, enabling him to live and work as a US citizen. He honestly and candidly talks about the impact his secret life had on those closest to him and the moment of his arrest by the FBI. If you can spare it, I'm asking listeners to contribute at least $3 per month to help keep us on the air, although larger amounts are welcome too. Plus, you get that sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a monthly financial supporter, and you bask in the warm glow of knowing that you are helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. I'm delighted to welcome Jack Barsky to our Cold War conversation. And what was the definition of your mission? What were you supposed to do? Because you were going to arrive in the US as effectively a nobody.
There was never a task list. There was never, you got to do this, and this. The one thing that was clearly defined was the first 2 years, you get authentic U.S. documentation and get a job, any kind of job, and then we'll take it from there. Well, the take it from there was actually, the plan was to move me back to Europe and set me up with a business so that I could then return with some wealth back to the United States and, you know, be probably would be considered upper middle class, where I could, you know, join a country club and mingle with people who were important. So my focus was political intelligence. Right. I was sort of trained to gather political information, get close to decision makers in the foreign policy realm, or at least people who would influence those decisions. But there was really no plan that says, well, this is how you go about this. You just get to know. It was very fuzzy, you know, just make as many contacts as you can and, you know, move up in society. The problem was that Plan A didn't function. I was not able to acquire a passport. The passport agent who looked at my application had some doubts. Actually, it's a quote. He said, "Sir, we have some concerns about your identity. Would you please fill out this extra this auxiliary questionnaire?" So I looked at the questionnaire and. The first question was, where did you go to high school? Okay, boom, that's like an explosion. Because if I fill that out, I had a cover story that said I attended Peter Stuyvesant High School in Manhattan, but there would have been no record of Jack Barsky having gone, because Jack Barsky died when he was 5 years old. So I knew that this wouldn't work. So I managed to grab my my application and whatever documents I provided there. They were still lying in front of the guy, and I walked out of there. So now we had to go to Plan B, and Plan B, they sent me back to college. But, you know, Plan B would have required a very, very long ramp up to get to a point where I would have been really personally useful. I got there, but by that time I had long since stopped working with the KGB.
Yeah, right? And I think this sort of undermined your confidence in the competence of the KGB, because up until the point you arrived in the US, you thought they were very effective and were giving you really good training.
The undermining started pretty much the first day I was in New York. The mitigating circumstances were such that I had spent 3 months in Canada on a practice trip just to go visit. And I had a couple of minor tasks to execute there. First day in New York, first impression of New York. So I'm on a bus from LaGuardia Airport that goes right into Midtown Manhattan at the Grand Central Station. And as we emerge in Manhattan, and I'm looking out the window, and I said, my God, these streets are really narrow. I felt like squeezed compared to those big avenues that you find in Moscow. They're like five lanes each way, and there's trees, and the buildings are a little bit set back. It feels like sort of a grandiose kind of roadway. Well, in Manhattan, you got them skyscrapers left and right, and they're much higher than the buildings in the east. And so you get the impression that Fifth Avenue was maybe only two lanes, but in fact it is five. So that was my first impression. The very first indication of what was to come was the ignorance by the KGB with regard to what it's like to live in the United States. So they gave me the addresses and names and addresses of three hotels where they figured these are hotels where you can, you know, pay by the month, which is fundamentally cheaper. And I took a walk from Grand Central. One of those hotels was nearby, within maybe 10 blocks to the south, in a nice neighborhood. I walk in there and I ask them, so what's your monthly fee? And I got an answer. It was well over $1,000, maybe $1,500. And my cash reserves were down to about $6,000. I said to myself, well, that's not going to work. It's way too expensive. On top of it, I had the good sense of thinking, how do I justify spending that kind of money when I don't have a job? Where's my income coming from? So I had to go find something a lot cheaper. So that's the first time I complained about, you know, bad instructions. And there were other things that happened throughout where I had to really learn what life is like in the United States. They didn't have a clue. Now, and the dangerous part of that statement is they didn't know that they didn't have a clue. They thought just because, you know, we worked for the United Nations for 2, 3, 4, 5 years, and, you know, we had contacts with Americans, and we may have recruited some people, and we went shopping in the stores, we took the subway. That doesn't mean anything. You never applied for a job. You never pretended to be one of them. I had to just slowly learn, and it took altogether about close to 5 years for me to really become comfortable as an American. Again, that goes to the claim that I made that they picked the right guy, right? Yeah. I also got lucky
couple of times now. But you know, I pretty much was on my own, because I very quickly knew that the instructions that they gave me, the few that I still got through the radio transmissions, were useless. So I just made my own decisions, and then I told them what I did decide. And I was never overridden, never criticized for doing that.
Yeah, yeah, because you mentioned that you, in later life, you met somebody who had also been an illegal in the US who'd got recalled during the 1988 scare. Did he sort of share the same difficulties that he'd had as well, in terms of, you know, his training didn't really cover a lot of the scenarios he was faced with?
Well, I had one day with him and his wife, and there wasn't enough time in the day to talk about everything, because he came to the U.S. as a married individual. I never asked him, because he's still sort of private, but I understand that he might be working on his memoir now. I never asked him, for instance, what was your cover story? He now speaks English with an accent. Most likely he had a different cover story. He may have, you know, sold himself as a Czech or somebody from Austria who immigrated. Yeah. But the one thing I know, that he got much better training than me. He trailed me by 5 years. And, for instance, he had this wonderful opportunity to travel through a whole bunch of Eastern European countries, all expenses paid, with an forged American passport. That's great training, man. If you get to go to Budapest in those days as an American, you obviously have to have hard cash. You know, you lived a good life.
Yeah.
And I said to them, I really hate you. On top of it, this guy never had any task other than establishing himself. They had no other task, no spotting potential recruits, no issuing reports about what Americans thinking, no special tasks, nothing. And he spent 5 years, him and his wife. He's back to being a German. That's a big difference. Because I took a whole lot longer. I spent a whole lot longer in the country. I don't consider myself German anymore in terms of who I am today.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if he does publish those memoirs and he wants to come on a very popular Cold War podcast, then do send him in my direction, Jack.
I will certainly do so. He still speaks English, of course. And his wife would make a nice addition, and he has a few twists and turns to his story, which are like, they'd be good for a movie too.
Okay. Well, absolutely. Yeah. Was there any other faulty advice that the KGB gave you?
The next one was what kind of a job I should be able to look into. That advice was also dead wrong. So eventually I became my own expert, and they recognized that I knew more than any of those guys, because whatever decision I made that went against what was recommended, they readily accepted.
So they must have put a lot of trust in you
at
that point.
Yes, they did.
And how were you communicating back to them? Were you receiving messages via a number station?
Yeah, numbers, but it was not spoken. It was Morse code. I spent quite a bit of time training on Morse code. I was told that that's safer in terms of the quality. The spoken word is, when the signal is weak, maybe more difficult to decipher than the dits and the das that goes with Morse code. Once a week, every Thursday at 9:15 in the evening. That's when it never failed. Once a week for 10 years at 9:15 in the evening. I complained about that too, because that established a pattern
which was not good because I meant Jack is never available on Thursday. That's like really silly. And they told me, yeah, well, we can't change it, whatever. I'm guessing they were using Cuban resources and didn't have full control over those.
Right. Right. And how did you communicate back to them?
Yeah, well, with snail mail.
Right.
Secret writing letters. I was limited to 2 pages per letter. And you would write sort of an open letter, dear so-and-so, and, you know, you make things up. And I'm pretty good at making things up. You know, it looked like there was an ongoing correspondence with that individual. And then on top of that, you put a secret message. It's not a lot of information you can put on 2 pages of paper. Particularly, it had to be in sort of block printed letters. And any kind of information that had names, addresses, and so forth in there had to be encrypted. So, and on top of it, every 3 months, I had to give a detailed finance report, believe it or not. So the real estate that I had available to me, that I had in the beginning, I had 2 of what we call in the business convenience addresses. I had 2 of them. That means once a month I could mail a letter to one and the other. So in other words, I had 4 pages that I could work with. Occasionally, when I had way too much to transmit, I would write this down on paper, photograph the paper, and then I would hand over the undeveloped cartridge in a dead drop operation. That happened, I think, 2 or 3 times.
Initially, you start work as a bike messenger, which is the only work you can get, and that's a very arduous role. But eventually, you work your way up, and you're studying as well, aren't you? And you managed to get a job as a computer programmer.
I did. I went back to college based on the fact that, you know, the plan A didn't work. Plan B was to get a degree. And I picked, and I think it was the right pick, I picked computer systems as a major, and I managed to get an entry-level job as a programmer. And that did rather well. That's not surprising. So within a couple of years, I was promoted several times and I was well established. And that was a time when my direction was slightly changed. For the first time, I was asked to see if I can steal some technology. And I still remember that the meeting that I had with an agent from a different department, and he was quite honest with me, and he says, "Hey, listen, we got a problem. We're falling behind technologically. You know, we need to catch up. So whatever you can get your hands on, let's see if we can get it." Now, the easiest matter to transmit and hand over to the Soviets would have been software. You know, computers were rather bulky in those days. We're talking about IBM mainframes. And I managed to copy one sizable software that was widely used and probably is still used as a foundation for running enterprises. I kind of doubt that it was very useful for the Soviets because it only works if you have the processes in place, and it works in a capitalist environment, not necessarily in a planned economy. Mm-hmm. So, but at least I tried.
Yeah. And during this period, you met somebody else in the US as well, didn't you? Your first US wife.
Yeah. You can't live a normal life as a, you know, as an American, as an undercover agent, without socializing, without having female companionships. And so I met this really good looking young woman who appeared to be very, very safe to be somewhat intimate with, because she She was originally from South America, and she wouldn't know, she wouldn't find out, you know, that there was something not quite right about me in terms of, like, you know, my birth and my whole backstory and so forth. But then I found out that she was illegal in the country. And so here started an interesting journey, and I had pity on her. I liked her a lot. And I said, okay, you know, let's see if I can help you. And indeed, we married, and I applied for a green card on her behalf, and it all worked because I had the proper documentation necessary for that.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
And then she became pregnant, and that changed my life.
And before we cover that, I just wanted to ask you, I mean, how are you dealing with these effective three different lives mentally, where one, you're a KGB agent, the other one, you're married to somebody in the US, and the third one, you're married to somebody in the GDR?
At one word, compartmentalization. I mean, literally, I had a manufactured dual personality. And even today, I have a hard time translating between English and German. I'm fluent in both languages, but don't make me translate. The sections of my brain that contain the vocabulary of the two languages don't talk to each other very well. And so my American and German ego didn't talk to each other. And I have pretty much proof for that in terms of behaviors, that the German was engaged in that the American wasn't, and vice versa. That's, you know, to a point I've been able to, like, bring the two together, but there's still a residual impact of that dual personality that, you know, in my case, it was almost impossible not to develop.
Yeah. Yeah. But I guess trying to manage that relationship with your wife in the GDR must have been really difficult, being only able to see her perhaps, or see her and your son perhaps once a year.
Well, here's the sad part of it. I love this woman dearly, but over time, she was never my focus, and that's really, if she had been, I wouldn't have left for the U.S. She was just there and convenient to go back to. That's a horrible thing to admit, but it is what it is. And so I never had a problem leaving. I was happy to arrive, but, you know, when it was time, you know, because I visited, every 2 years I went back to Moscow, and I met her, and then later on her and my son. I was glad to arrive and, you know, bring a bunch of presents and, you know, embrace her and kiss her and be nice to her and love her. But I had never had a problem leaving. And that, because I was so darn cold inside and selfish, because I still, deep down inside, I sort of knew that I was serving a higher cause. That eventually became rationalization, because that cause, you know, became rather diluted the longer I lived in the United States.
Yeah. And with your U.S. wife, the birth of Chelsea, your daughter, changes your perspective. I was going to say massively, but it's even more important than that.
Yeah, there's no, the word is pretty good, but it as radical as it gets. Because, and I think there's a lot of men who can relate to that. When we experience in person the birth of a child and watch that child, and in my case, it's a little girl, right, grow up, what I experienced, what I tell people is like a massive attack of unconditional love. I had no idea that I had that in me. I had no idea what that was. And so that overrode eventually, that emotion overrode every selfish bone in my body. Because when I decided to stay in the U.S. when I was supposed to go back, there was nothing in it for me other than being able to take the risk and hopefully be able to take care of this child. She's now 33 years old, and we're both really glad that I stayed.
So you carry on your work for the KGB through to 88, and then you get a message from them.
Yeah, I got the message that I should urgently leave the country. We had an emergency plan. I was supposed to go to Canada, from which place they would have exfiltrated me back to Moscow, because they had good reason. I never found out what the reason was, to suspect that I was now under investigation. The reason that I know that they really believed it is because a friend of mine, now a friend of mine, who was also an illegal at the time in the United States, same time I was there, was also called back at the same time. And then 3 months later, they sent him back because false alarm. Anyway, but I didn't know this. And this is when I had to make that decision. My Chelsea was like, she was 18 months old. And I go and I desert this child, or I stay, taking a whole bunch of risks, including, you know, being subject to the wrath of the KGB, who I knew wasn't taking this kind of insubordination very lightly. That was the moment of decision, and I, you know, Chelsea won.
Yeah, and in the book, it's interesting because you the decision doesn't sound as clear cut, because you actually go to the dead drop,
yes,
to pick up your exfiltration documents, except they're
money.
Not there. Yeah, and the money. and they're not there. So, you know, all sorts of thoughts were going through your mind, but obviously Chelsea won out in the end.
Yes, and you're right. This was not clear cut. And if I, you know, if I can put a number on it, it was 51-49. I was constantly going back and forth, because I did have a family in Germany. You know, and so that was the biggest counterweight. But eventually Chelsea won out, and I'm a believing Christian now, and I think that somehow God had a play in this, had a hand in this, to just nudge me in the right direction.
Yeah. And so you're going into work and you notice a red dot on your way in, which is a sign again from the KGB to say you have to come back.
This was the first signal that says, hey, emergency. I had no clue what that meant. And I ignored that one. And then a week later, I got more of an explanation in a radio transmission saying, well, we have reason to believe that the FBI is about to arrest you. You must come home. And I ignored that too. And eventually somebody actually came up to me, and a Russian agent, and very briefly just whispered into my ears, you got to come home or else you're dead. That's a verbal quote that I will never forget. And that's pretty much when it was decision time, because at that point I couldn't play for time anymore. Up until that point, there could have been all kinds of things wrong. I could have been in a hospital, the radio could have been broken, blah, blah, blah. But here's the guy who saw me, talked to me, so now they knew that I knew that they knew. So it was decision time.
Yeah, and you come up with a quite brilliant plan to escape the clutches of the KGB by playing on an area that you know they are extremely fearful of and would be believable.
Yeah, HIV/AIDS. Clearly that was, as I indicated before, a death sentence in the late 80s, early 90s. There was no cure. There was nothing that really prevent you from dying from this. And they believed it. And I had reason to believe that they didn't know about the child. They didn't know about my marriage. They stayed away from me. They did not ever check on anything that I told them. They didn't know that I graduated as valedictorian from college, which I would have been reprimanded for that, for sure. So they had every reason to believe what I told them, because it didn't make, based on what they knew, it wouldn't have made any sense for me to come up with that lie, because all the good things for me were back in East Germany or Moscow, because the year before I had received the Order of the Red Banner, second highest decoration of the Soviet Union. So there was just no way for them not to believe it, and they didn't believe it.
Because they continued paying your wife, I think, and
they gave us some of the savings. I asked them in my goodbye letter, please, you know, give my German wife the money that was saved on my account. Based on my son telling me that she received a significant amount of money, probably not everything, probably an agent kept some of that for themselves.
And so your career progression continues, and you're living in rural Pennsylvania,
yeah,
with your wife and then two kids, because Jesse, your son, is born as well. But in the meantime, you're not aware that a certain Russia called Vasily Matrokin, he worked for the KGB and has taken a load of files to British intelligence, because the US intelligence rather rashly turned him down.
Well, this is what happened. I was told he actually went to the US embassy on a Saturday, and they had a junior CIA person talk to him, and he said, well, this is old stuff. We're not interested in it. Now there's a career limiting move.
Yeah, I would say so, but the British obviously,
yeah, MI6 says, come on in, let's have a cup of tea.
yeah. And in these files, there is a mention of a certain Jack Barsky, which then ends up with the FBI. At this point, you're not aware that the FBI is on your trail, or indeed that they've bought the house next door.
At that point, it was like 8-9 years after I had resigned. I had forgotten that I ever was an agent. I had put my German past out of my mind. I knew that I would never, ever go back to Germany. So, and I clearly did. I stopped taking all these precautions to see whether somebody is following me, because the original communication by the KGB that the FBI was investigating me was wrong. Therefore, I wasn't doing anything else. No way that, I was just a private citizen, and I was completely clueless that I was under investigation for about two and a half years before the FBI introduced themselves.
Yes, and the way they introduced themselves, and again, I would highly recommend Jack's book. It really gives a lot more detail than we're having in this conversation. But you're driving home one evening, and at the toll booth, as you come off the motorway, a state trooper steps out and asks you to pull over. And then out of the corner of your eye, you see another man who then proceeds to put an FBI identification in front of you. How did you feel at that moment?
Numb. And I can only repeat what the agent who produced the FBI document saw. He said, I went white as a sheet. So I guess all the blood went out of my brain, head, and I, for a while, I couldn't think. But I recovered rather quickly. So, you know, they asked me to join them in their vehicle. And as I step in there, I see his partner in the back, who was sitting next to me in the back seat, and he had a gun strapped to his ankle. So, you know, there was a reminder that this was real. But, you know, and this is confirmed by the agent who detained me, and I emphasize it was detention, not arrest. The two first sentences that I uttered, the first one was, am I under arrest? And the answer was no. And then I said, so what took you so long? It is what it is. You know,
that's a very cool answer, isn't it, really?
Well, you know what? That was my survival instinct, because immediately I knew that I had to make them like me. Because if I'm a jerk, I could easily wind up in jail. And, you know, it isn't that hard for me to pretend to be likable. I actually have that in me. That's one of the qualifications to become an agent, right? You know, people need to sort of be able to relate to you. So, and instinctively I played that card, and it worked.
Yeah, because I guess, you know, when that FBI agent stepped out, what would have been going through your mind is, the KGB think I'm dead, so they're not going to get me out of this. I'm going to go to jail, and my wife and kids I'm not going to see for maybe 20 odd years or something like that, I guess.
Well, the danger was that, I go to jail, nobody will get me out because I'm dead. Germany had no reason to, you know, act on my behalf. And so the danger was that I go to jail, my wife gets deported because she got her citizenship was acquired based on my documentation, which was illegal. And the kids would wind up in an orphanage someplace, wardens of the state. That was the extreme danger. And that, you know, I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about this, because this would have destroyed all of us.
Yeah. And in your, I'm going to call it a debriefing with the FBI, presumably they were asking you how you had communicated, or did they thought you were still active at this point, didn't they?
At that time, they pretty much concluded that I wasn't anymore, because they had enough time to watch me over 2.5 years. And as FBI agent Joe Riley would tell you, you can learn a lot about a person just by watching them.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
And he did do a lot of watching. He also spent time going through my garbage in the summertime and complain about it because it smelled. But you know, for a while they thought I might still be active, but they determined when they finally made the move, they were pretty sure I wasn't, not 100%, because they had a whole bunch of agents stationed around the area, because they let me go home. And I was introduced to the head of the team, you know, the surveillance team. And this guy was pretty adamant and very strong. He said, by the way, if you think of running, we got every intersection covered. So don't you, and, you know, I was not saying it because I didn't want to be a wise guy, but I was thinking to myself, where the heck am I going to run to?
Yeah. Yeah, because didn't they have a problem with a Cuban friend of yours that was renting a room to a Soviet diplomat?
Yeah, that came out after I went public. They actually, when they found out that I was working rather closely with a Cuban national who had immigrated with his parents, who had rented an apartment to a Soviet diplomat. Some of them thought international conspiracy, and apparently my friend was subjected to a rather harsh interview, and he got really ticked off.
Yeah,
the whole thing that obviously was a dead end. But for a while, some folks in the FBI thought they were like really about to catch a real big fish. Well, that fish turned out to be a minnow. Espionage-wise.
Yeah, and how did your wife react to the news that you were, a former KGB agent?
Well, she actually knew, and this is actually what triggered the detention. They had the house bugged, and there was a moment when her and I, my wife and I, had an argument, and I was just trying to make clear to her that, you know, I'm really on her side, and I said to her, by the way, let me tell you something. This is what I risked to be with you and Chelsea. I used to be a Russian agent, and I sort of defected, and they were listening to this. The FBI was listening to this. So they had my confession on tape. So she already knew. She was extremely uncomfortable with this. Even when the FBI then came to visit the house and talked to her very nicely, she didn't know how to process that. And so I think this whole thing really put a death nail into the marriage, because she was already not a very trusting person, and now she knew she was living with an ex-agent who cannot be trusted. And, you know, that kind of trust, once it's lost, is very difficult to establish or reestablish.
Yeah, yeah. And you waited until Chelsea was 18 until you told her. What was her reaction to that news?
Well, she was like, wow. and you know, and I told her that she changed my life. Well, how much more proof do you need that your father really loves you? You know, that's and you know, that bond is indestructible. We can always go back to that, and that's it's one thing to say I love you. It's another thing to, you know, throw yourself in front of a bus, survive. And I didn't throw myself in front of a bus, but it was the equivalent. Okay.
Yeah. And she became quite curious around her half brother in Germany as well.
Yeah. When sometime later, after I disclosed my past to her, I told her that she actually had a half brother in Germany. And now she was like on a mission to find the fellow. And initially she failed until he wound up on the internet because of the institution where he got his doctorate required him to establish a web identity And that's where she found him, sent him an email, and, you know, with some questions, are you, is your first name this? And do you have a dad that disappeared? And so he sent an email back, and it started with, hello, little sister. Wow. So that was the beginning of connecting the two pieces of my family. So now I have a picture of all four of my adult children, because I have a little one who wasn't available at the time, being together with me in the same picture. And that is Chelsea's achievement. I was deathly afraid of facing the son that I had deserted. You know, there's one thing to be brave, and there's another thing to be occasionally a coward. And in that respect, I was a big coward. I had nothing. There was nothing I could have told. I thought, told the fellow why I did what I did. Well, when he met me in Chelsea, we were just sitting there in my living room, and I explained the situation. And within an hour, he said, I understand. And that was the beginning of, you know, connecting again. He calls me dad now.
Wow. That's a huge thing to say to you, isn't it? After, you know, thinking that you were effectively dead.
Right.
bit lost for words there. But when you told Jesse, because there's a great story you told me about him.
Yeah, I was a manager at the time. And so in the U.S., they have this take your child to work day. It used to be take your daughter and then you can take your son. So I took my son one day, and we were spent time in the office, and there's a telephone, a computer, and a whiteboard, and people walk in and out, and that's all he saw of my unglamorous job. So I overheard him talk to his friend. He said, my dad doesn't really do any work. You know, he sits in the office all day, makes phone calls, and draws things on the whiteboard. I don't know what he does. And all of a sudden, when I sat down with him in Chelsea, and when he was 18, on his 18th birthday, Chelsea and I told him about my past, and his eyes got bigger and bigger and bigger, because this faceless, useless desk jockey had become a man of intrigue, an international undercover agent. I mean, like, he was so excited. You know, that's a boy reaction.
I can imagine that scene. I mean, it just goes to show how little you actually know about your parents' past when you actually think about it.
yeah, you never know.
No.
They're hiding.
No, exactly, exactly. And I love the fact that Joe Riley, the FBI agent that didn't arrest you but detained you, is now your golfing buddy, isn't he?
Yeah, he was while we were still living in the same area. Now that I live in Georgia and he is still in Pennsylvania, we're not playing golf anymore, but he's still a friend. I was at his house was last December. We still talk regularly. And he wrote a really, really, really nice afterword for my book that I cherish a lot.
Yeah, he did. You're absolutely right there. And have you been back to Germany since to connect with your old friends or
yeah,
anybody?
Four times. The first time, as soon as I got my citizenship, I made a beeline to Germany, and it was a trip down memory lane, trip down into my past, connected with lots and lots of different people, including my first girlfriend. The scene when we met is described in the book. It's a phenomenal movie scene. How two people in their 60s meet again after so many years, when one had dumped the other, who then decides that really was a mistake.
It is a lovely scene.
I didn't make it up. It happened exactly the way I'm describing it. And, you know, I met a lot of people. And then the second time I came with CBS 60 Minutes. And then I went again for a class reunion where I was able to tell the first girl I had a crush on after so many years. I said, by the way, the only reason I came to this reunion is because I wanted to tell Jutta that I had a crush on her. And she spontaneously said, you should have told me. I would have come to the United States with you. Didn't miss a beat. And then the last one was a bit over a year ago when I was able to take my current wife and my last one and my then seven-year-old to Germany because I had a public appearance, a paid appearance.
And your East German wife is, presumably she didn't want any further contact with you.
We had one phone conversation, and it was primarily her saying what was on her mind. And it was my duty to listen. There was not much I could say in response because in that relationship, I was the guilty party. No explanation. No, there was nothing I could say. There was some indication that she might actually want to stay in contact, but she reversed that, and that's the end of that. There's no more conversation. No more contact. People always ask me, would I do it again? Did I make the right decision? And, you know, you have to, you know, you look back on your life. The decisions that I made were based on what I knew at the time, whether it was perfect knowledge or not, what I knew, and was also based on who I was, which was not a mature individual. And I can only say this was not in any way manipulative or planned or intended to harm somebody, but I didn't see the long-term impact on others, but as well as myself. You know, you don't come out of this kind of life undamaged. So bottom line is, the answer is always, yes, I would, but I'm glad it turned out the way it did.
That is a great line to end on. And we have further photos, videos, and information on this episode in our show notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Don't forget, if you'd like to get one of those Cold War Conversations coasters, help keep us on the air, then head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye.
Thanks again to all our financial supporters of the podcast, but a special thanks to our Politburo level Patreons, who are Sam Hardwick, Nicholas Butter, and Jeffrey Jones, who are supporting us at $30 per month. Thank you.
Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.